This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of How to Vaccinate the World. I'm Tim Harford. The vaccines are coming thick and fast. New vaccines are reporting good results and the now familiar brand names are being rolled out quite rapidly in some places. Or should I say, at pace. Everything's at pace these days. Usain Bolt broke the 100 metre sprint record at pace. Sir Lewis Hamilton drives cars at pace. Where was I? Oh yes, well, we have about half a dozen effective vaccines and well over 100 million doses injected. But the virus is mutating, and that means vaccines will need to evolve as well, and quickly. So this week, we're going to be greedy. Why don't we have more vaccines? Why aren't they being produced faster? And next time there's a dangerous virus, how can we ensure we don't leave vaccine development to chance? There is a straightforward system for encouraging the development of new vaccines: intellectual property. If you develop a new vaccine, you get a patent, which means you get to decide who produces it. And if your vaccine is useful, then people will buy it and you'll make money. But my guests this week will help me explore the weaknesses in that system and whether we can improve the incentives to produce lots of vaccines quickly. And those guests are...
Michael Kremer. I'm an economics professor at the University of Chicago.
Hello, my name is Anna Mauser. I head up policy for the vaccines team at the Wellcome Trust, which is a philanthropic foundation that funds vaccines, amongst other things.
Hello, I'm Patrick Tipu, based in Cape Town, South Africa, with BioVac, a local vaccine manufacturing company.
Well, welcome to all of you. And it is Michael, too modest to mention the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. Anyone else have a Nobel Prize they can't be bothered to mention? I don't have one, sadly. But anyway, welcome to all of you. And let me start with Anna. Anna Mauser, what do you think is holding back pharmaceutical companies from making the investments required to produce lots of vaccines quickly?
I wish I could say there was one thing that would make the difference and make it easier to develop vaccines for many of these diseases, but there isn't. There's no shortage of scientific potential. But what happens is vaccine candidates really hit sort of a wall of cold reality in terms of investment decisions that need to be made around them. And one of the biggest issues is the opportunity cost. For a lot of major pharmaceutical companies, the decision on whether to invest in a promising vaccine rubs up against all of the other products that they might be looking at preparing. And I mean, something that really struck me when we were researching this area at Wellcome is that often a drug for ulcers can be far more profitable than any vaccine for a potential epidemic. And that really is concerning.
Sorry to interrupt. Why is that? Because, I mean, a COVID-19 vaccine, but really, you know, any vaccine, you need to inject billions of people. You would have thought there was a lot of money in that. Why would an ulcer drug be more profitable?
Well, we've seen the reality of what's happened when, you know, COVID has become this huge, incredibly vast global pandemic affecting all of us. But at the early stages, when you're thinking about making these investments in potential vaccines, you simply don't know. There's complete uncertainty as to whether a potential pathogen ends up becoming something that does have that global impact. There's also a whole set of diseases which predominantly affect people in low-income countries, and there's almost no high-income market. And these sorts of vaccines find it very hard to progress into phase three trials. But I'd also bring in the regulatory environment, because ultimately all the investments that are made into potential vaccines hinge on whether they get licensed for use. And there aren't enough regulators across the world with the capacity to actually license some of these vaccines. And that's a really fundamental issue too.
So a lot of different issues there. The fact that regulators might lack the capacity or interest to license the product, the fact that you might be developing a vaccine for a disease that turns out to fizzle out of its own accord, and the fact that a lot of these diseases are diseases of people who don't have any money and thus don't have much capacity to pay for the vaccine. Well, Michael Kremer, you've been thinking about this for, what, 15, 20 years? And you've been, or maybe longer, and I know that you've been advocating an idea called advanced market commitments. So just tell us what advanced market commitments are designed to achieve.
So Rachel Glenister and I first proposed the idea of advanced market commitments in the early 2000s. So the idea of an advanced market commitment is that a group of sponsors would promise a top-up payment for the first doses sold, and that incentivizes firms to do the research and development. But in return, the firms would agree to sell the vaccine at close to the cost of production afterwards.
So just to put a number on this, you're saying you want to produce a $30 malaria vaccine, and we promise that we'll subsidize the first 1 billion doses of that malaria vaccine so that the people who receive it only pay $5, and or the governments who purchase it on their behalf only pay $5, and the donors, you know, Bill Gates, the World Bank, Gavi, whoever it is, the donors pay $25. And that's the basic idea.
That is the basic idea. But then there's a commitment that in the long run, the price of the vaccine would have some limit. So if just to make this, you know, more concrete, there was a case where advanced market commitments were used. The first case was a group of donors put up $1.5 billion for an advanced market commitment for a vaccine protecting against pneumococcus, which is a major cause of child mortality in 2009. And there was actually already a vaccine for the strains of pneumococcus that were common in the developed world, but no firm had yet developed and produced a vaccine against the strains of pneumococcus that were common in the developing world. So the donor said that if a firm produced such a vaccine and agreed to sell it for $3.50 per dose long-term, they would top that up with an extra $3.50 per dose until the $1.5 billion ran out.
And has it run out? And that's worked, has it?
Well, two vaccines were qualified shortly afterwards, and you know, hundreds of millions of people have been immunized, and it's estimated that these pneumococcus vaccines have saved 700,000 lives.
And go on, Anna.
I was just going to say, and the models being used right now for COVID vaccines by COVAX and Gavi, and I think it's had an incredible effect. Just wanted to add that in.
Well, I was going to ask, actually, are advanced market commitments only being used in the context of COVAX, this international effort that is supposed to give access equitably to vaccines for every country, rich or poor? Or are advanced market commitments also being used as part of the push by rich countries to accelerate vaccine development?
Well, so the term advanced, like many terms, the term evolves over time and maybe expands. But I think the key thing is that many governments and international organizations, COVAX, the international effort, but also national governments, the US government, the UK government, many others, made commitments to buy vaccines up front, even before they were approved. You know, there are obviously some differences between the way that these contracts are being written and the way contracts were written in the pneumococcus case, but I think these are different cases. So in fact, you know, some adjustment is warranted. But I think, you know, this is the dominant approach, I think, for COVID-19 early on was for countries and international organizations to commit to purchase vaccines even before the vaccines had finished testing. And that allowed the production capacity to start being put in place early, which is part of the reason we have the capacity that we have now. Would have been nice, in my view, if this had been done at an even larger scale, but it's good that what was done was done.
Let me turn to Patrick. What about making vaccines in developing countries? You're speaking to us from Cape Town.
Yeah.
What is the vaccine manufacturing scene like in South Africa and in Africa more broadly?
I'm at BioVac in South Africa. It's the only human vaccine manufacturing facility in South Africa. And one of a few, probably a handful, dotted across the continent of Africa. So it's a sobering truth that many of the vaccine doses used in Africa are imported into Africa. So I think that one of the points to note is that subsidization of vaccines and the vaccine supply obviously is a good thing because it is important that vaccines reach where they need to reach and make a difference, especially in the poorer regions of the world. But inadvertently, this creates a negative market force for the development of a local industry because many of the African governments, by way of example, depend on support and supply from Gavi and UNICEF for their vaccines. And therefore, the local vaccine market does not actually exist in Africa. And so this creates a conundrum for a vaccine manufacturer like BioVac, who wants to supply not only into South Africa, but into the broader region as well, to get up to speed and compete with the bigger companies. And that is problematic and very, very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's difficult.
What makes it difficult?
Well, because you need lots of money, you need lots of time, and you need lots of expertise. You need a good regulatory system. And all of these factors need to line up and converge simultaneously. But all of this can only be done if there is an investment case on the table that is robust, and that depends on the market.
And just explain to me, and I know, I'm sure every economist you talk to has this kind of question, but why does it matter to manufacture the vaccine domestically? Obviously, every country needs its own domestic industry, but you know, here in the UK, we buy smartphones from China. We don't make smartphones here in the UK. And we get a lot of our movies from Hollywood, and we get a lot of our wine from France and from Australia. We don't need to, and for that matter, from South Africa. We don't need to make it all ourselves.
Yeah.
So why is it important to make vaccines domestically?
Well, you know, I suppose one could argue that that one needs wine to live.
That is true. That is true.
One doesn't need a movie to live. So that becomes, I suppose, less important. But I think that COVID is a very real example of why we need local industry. And when I say local industry, I'm talking about local industry in a regional way. If you look at the map of the globe, you will see dotted around the other continents are multiple manufacturing capabilities, except in Africa. One of the silver linings on this dark COVID cloud has been the attention that it's drawn to this issue of African vulnerability, African dependency when it comes to vaccine supply. The issue now is, I think there's enough interest, there's enough attention that has been drawn to the fact. The issue now is, how do we translate this into, first of all, a plan, and then how do we action that plan?
Yes, I think a lot of politicians have suddenly realized, this stuff matters. Anna, we've talked many times in this series about how incredibly rapid progress has been and how these vaccines have appeared at an unprecedented speed. Do you think that we've done enough, or do you think that over the last year or so, governments have made obvious mistakes in their strategy or simply in just not putting enough funding behind developing vaccines?
I think 2020 was a really remarkable year, actually, in terms of what it proved was possible in vaccine development if you put all your efforts behind it. And we've seen sort of, it's like shaking a snow globe almost. Some of the ways in which we did things in the past have been shaken up in a positive way. And I think, you know, there are silver linings to this. For instance, the fact that we now have not one, but I think two or possibly even more, I don't know what day it is at the moment, but more RNA vaccines. It could have taken, you know, a decade to see an RNA vaccine come through without the crisis that we've had to live through with COVID. And that's been really, really important. We know we're dealing with a virus now that is mutating. We're seeing more and more variants come through. So we haven't finished the job on COVID. We will need to continue to invest in improvements and potentially new versions of existing vaccines. That's going to be critical. And, you know, I think as you get vaccines on the market already, it can become more difficult to incentivize those later down the line versions, which often hold really important improvements on the delivery side. For instance, we've seen the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that only requires one dose. For global access, that is a real game changer, actually, having a single dose vaccine. And there will be other improvements that can come through. And so making sure that that innovation continues is really, really important.
And I wanted to ask Michael, just bringing us back to what's happened over the last 12 months, did governments such as the UK and the US, who I think are regarded as having done pretty well in terms of funding vaccines and supporting vaccine development, did they do enough? Have you been watching and going, they're doing okay, or have you been watching in frustration that people are simply not understanding how much money they really should be putting behind this?
Yeah, I think we should have done even more. And you know, it's hard to comprehend the scale of these numbers. And just to illustrate this, we're losing hundreds of thousands of lives every month. The estimated short-run GNP losses from COVID are $500 billion every month. And that's not including of the value of the health losses that are occurring due to COVID, not just directly, but indirectly, because people aren't getting other necessary health care. It's not including the value of the interruptions to education. You know, we did some calculations, and we estimate that the value of the ability to produce one course of vaccination per year is $1,750.
So just to be clear there, Michael, so if I have a lab in my basement, and I know it doesn't work like this, but that lab is able to produce a single dose of COVID-19 vaccine, you're saying that that capacity just to produce that one dose per year is nearly $2,000, $1,750.
That's right. That's the value to society of being able to end the epidemic slightly earlier, because basically the time to vaccinate a population is the size of the population divided by the production and delivery capacity. So if we had more capacity, we could end the epidemic sooner. Or, you know, we may not end the epidemic. We may move into a phase of something much closer to normalcy. So while the value to society is something like $1,700, if you think about how much a vaccine manufacturer could get, you know, the price of a vaccine course might be, in some cases, as low as $6, maybe $30, $40. Now, there might be very good reasons for society to put limits on prices during epidemics. And, you know, some companies have decided just from an ethical point of view they would do this. And I think they would limit their prices. And I think other companies realize that if they tried to charge $1,700 for a course of vaccine, the governments would step in from a regulatory perspective. So my point isn't that the price of vaccine should be $1,700. The point is that in a world where the price is what it is, the private incentives to produce vaccines and to install capacity are going to be much, much smaller than the social need for the capacity.
To what extent is it possible to prepare vaccines for diseases that don't exist yet? That we've, I mean, I don't know, I'm an economist, I don't understand this, but you sequence some coronavirus in bats or pangolins, and you say there's a risk that this jumps to humans, but it hasn't done so yet. Can we make a vaccine for that? Or is there any way we can prepare? Or do we just have to keep an eye out?
I think we can definitely do more to prepare. And one of the big challenges is how do you fund that preparedness work? And it's a challenge for vaccines, but it's a challenge more broadly for how you invest in preparedness as a whole. There are different families of viruses, and you can do research into these families of viruses. You can create viable vaccine candidates that are ready to go and ready to test. There's new technologies known as sort of platform technologies, which essentially are, I've heard them described as plug and play. You take the code of viruses, you plug it in, and it generates you these new candidates. It's not quite as simple as that, but hopefully you get the picture. And I think making sure that we invest in these as fully as we can to prepare for future disease threats is really vital.
Patrick, there's almost the moment Pfizer announced, I think they were the first to announce that they had a workable vaccine, almost immediately people started saying these pharmaceutical companies should be giving up their IP to allow manufacturers all around the world to speed up vaccine production. So to what extent is that happening, and to what extent does that actually solve the problems that we have?
I think obviously the whole IP issue in the face of a pandemic is a critical issue to discuss. And the example that I like to use when people ask me this question is, if Pfizer gave BioVac the full recipe of how to make their vaccine today, we who take a few years to get to a place where we could actually have the first dose out to the market. Because besides the infrastructure component that you have to build in, you have to bring the skills in, you have to develop the skills. And obviously, some companies are more advanced and they would be able to absorb that technology at a far more accelerated pace. But the issue of vaccines is really related to know-how. But I don't think that this notion of just broadly a company just giving up all the IP is going to solve the issue that we're trying to solve here, and that is how to get as many doses out as fast as possible.
Michael, is there still even now an opportunity to dramatically expand capacity? Because I know it takes a long time to build a vaccine factory and get production up and running. Are you saying it's not too late?
You know, I think there's more that we could do now. I think even at this fairly late stage, you know, if we got an additional billion doses of capacity, if it could be ready in 3 months, which would be tough, it would be worth $375 billion. If it took 6 months, it'd be worth $165 billion. So it's worth it to society to spend a lot to get that extra capacity, even if it wouldn't come online for a while. So I think at a minimum, given the enormous value of additional capacity, we should try to solicit proposals and go to vaccine manufacturers and say, give us a proposal. How much additional vaccine could you produce? How much would it cost? And how soon could you deliver it? And then those proposals could be judged, and you know, potentially multiple proposals could be funded. I think this is, you know, for some countries, maybe for the US and UK, we might have vaccinated most of our populations by the time this came online. But there are many other countries where vaccination either hasn't begun or has barely begun. And Speeding things up would be obviously worth it for the human lives, but even in purely economic terms, would be a very valuable investment.
And Anna? And I would add in, Tim, you know, we aren't even funding the basics yet. COVAX, which is the mechanism for sort of buying and distributing vaccines more globally, is chronically underfunded, even though you have these incredible potential return on investments in terms of the economic value that vaccinating the world can bring. So I think it really demonstrates to me where the data, the economic case meets the kind of political reality, in that governments are struggling with, you know, funding the pandemic response, all the kind of social security measures, and, you know, the health costs, the costs of shutdown rub up against this need to invest in expanding capacity. The economic case is really clear, and I think we have to do more, but it does definitely hit political reality and squeezed budgets and budget envelopes that people don't want to go beyond.
Thank you very much, everybody. I've got so many more questions I want to ask, but now it is time for What the Editor Doesn't Understand. And this week, our ever curious editor, Richard Varden, has a question about AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca says it isn't going to make a profit from the Oxford vaccine, at least not while the pandemic lasts. But Richard wants to know, is that a good thing? Don't we want companies to make money when they're making these vaccines that are saving people's lives? Well, you could all answer this one. Let me start with Anna. I mean, should we actually want companies to be making more money, not less?
Well, I think the AstraZeneca commitment is really laudable, and they have shown a commitment to trying to make their vaccine available globally and at the lowest possible price. And I find it hard to say that that is in any way a negative thing. And certainly we'd encourage other manufacturers also to do the same.
So good for them. But you did note before that ulcer drugs were more profitable than vaccines. And so even if they're giving up the profits, we want there to be a profit motive.
Oh, goodness. I mean, this is just such an exceptional situation that I think a move like that is really important. I think being realistic that companies need to turn around a profit is also important to remember. And I think it can be tempting to sort of forget that at times. We do need everybody around the table in developing vaccines and solving these problems. And that includes industry, it includes governments, it includes, you know, civil society. So we really have to see these issues as a shared endeavor and all play our role.
Now, Michael or Patrick, do either of you want to disagree? Or
I think there are two objectives society has. One objective is to make sure that we get the vaccine at an affordable price. The other objective is to create incentives to develop the vaccine. In economics speak, if you restricted yourself to a single variable that you could control, the price, if you go with a lower price, it's more affordable, but then you don't create the incentives to invest. The solution is to improve the terms of that trade-off. The value to the world of having more capacity is immense. If you can get it cheaply, it's worth trying to get it cheaply. If a company volunteers to provide that at cost, that's fantastic. But if there's other capacity that is just going to be more expensive, Well, it's worth paying for that.
Thought I'd like to just add my voice to Anna's sentiment, and I think it sets an example. But there is a tension in doing that, and it I think it speaks to this old concept, even in non-pandemic situations, of how do you get to a healthy market where the market can be supplied with what it needs, but the manufacturers can survive reasonably comfortably to be there tomorrow to provide the services that we need.
Yes, if it's all charity, then who is paying for the next vaccine to be developed?
Can I sneak in a really last point on that? I think there is a question of how we give economic value, in a sense, to some of the risk. And it's the same issue in climate. How do you value in economic terms some of these things that we all know are inherently valuable? And looking ahead, we'll need to figure out, I think, ways of doing that.
Well, I'm delighted that you're all so absorbed with Richard's question. He's going to be extremely pleased. But we've got questions from our listeners who are, of course, much more important than our editor. So and if you have a question to put to next week's panel or the panel for the week after that, just send in your questions at the email address vaccine@bbc.co.uk. I've got a really short, sweet question for Patrick from Julie. Julie would like to know how an adjuvant works.
Well, first of all, adjuvants, they're added to vaccines to induce a greater response, a stronger response by the immune system. And basically, they prime different arms of the immune system to respond in a far stronger way in the presence of smaller amounts of what we call the active pharmaceutical ingredient, the bit of the virus or the bit of the bacterium in the vaccine that actually does the job. So you don't have to add as much of that to a dose of vaccine if you have an adjuvant present. If the vaccine candidate allows for the addition of an adjuvant, you could then squeeze out a greater number of doses out of the same quantity of vaccine produced in a facility.
Okay, so I'm thinking of it as a bit like a shot of espresso before you read the morning newspaper. It's not necessarily essential, but if you get your espresso, you're going to be able to pay more attention when the newspaper lands in front of your nose.
Not quite.
Yeah, okay. I'm evidently not an immunologist, but okay. Thank you, Patrick. It's very kind of you. And that is all we have time for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Michael Kramer, Anna Mauser, and Patrick Tipu for joining us. If you've enjoyed this programme, note we are available as a podcast via BBC Sounds or otherwise. Please tell a friend or leave a review so people hear about us. Thank you for listening. I'm Tim Harford, and we will be back next week with another edition of How to Vaccinate the World. Until then, goodbye.
How to Vaccinate the World was presented by Tim Harford. The producers were Sandra Canthal and Josephine Cassidy. The editor was Richard Varden. It was recorded by Gareth Jones and mixed by me, James Beard.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner, the host of the You're Dead to Me podcast, and I have some good news. Now that we're all stuck at home, again, we are bringing back homeschool history. And if you missed out the first time, you don't know what it is, it's our fun, family-friendly and informative show about, well, you can probably guess, yeah, history. And yes, we're bringing back the obligatory sound effects, of course. This time out, get ready to learn about the Great Fire of London, ancient Egyptian religion, the Scottish Wars of Independence, Mary Seacole, and one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, though you'll have to tune in to find out which one. So, that's Homeschool History with me, Greg Jenner, on BBC Sounds.